on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Tonight's edition of the Orient Hour at Phoenix 98 FM. I'm Trevor Singfield in the studio, and in a short while I'll be joined by Lee Boyce in the studio. But we will now hand over to Steve Tongue, who hopefully is on the end of the line for us. Good evening, Steve.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Trevor. Good to hear from you again. While socially distanced, we hope the audio quality will be all right on the night. We're trying to keep the show going, a bit like those old London theatres, I think, that keep going in the Blitz. You know, we never closed. So what we'll try to do in this edition, without a weekend match to look back on, of course, Carlisle away, don't forget, is rearranged for next Tuesday night after Morecambe at home on Saturday. So we'll have some general Orient chat about recent form, players in and out. We'll reflect on the club's 2020 online review, in particular the wage cuts necessary to meet the salary cap. And if you followed that online, you'll have heard the chairman say we've made great progress this year. So we'll see if we all agree with that. And then we've got some nostalgia, the Jimmy Bloomfield years, with our special guest David Bloomfield, Jimmy's son, who followed the O's home and away during his dad's two spells in charge. Jim, of course, won the third division title in only his second full season with us, 1970, and after taking over at Leicester in the top division for 6 years, he came back and took us to the 78 FA Cup semi-final for the only time in our history before leaving and then dying at the tragically young age of 49 in 1983. Well, David Bloomfield also worked for the Football Association, which is where our paths first crossed. He worked for Barnet for a while. He's been a scout for the England C team. That's the England non-league team. And he now plays walking football for Leighton Orient, still living locally. So that interview will be in the second half of the programme. Now then, that's enough for me. Lee Boyce, if you've made it into the studio, we've missed you. You and Trevor, tell us about your impressions of the season, positives and negatives, whether sitting just behind the playoffs in ninth place is about right, do we think?
Yeah, at the moment, hello Steve anyway, but yeah, at the moment, I think it is. I think it's been a testing sort of start to the season. Frustrating, a lot of it, but I think we've got to accept where we are at the moment. I mean, it's still there is progression. There's a lot of progression coming in the first half of the season, which is a good thing. But yeah, I suppose you can't complain too much.
Trevor, agree with that?
Yeah, I'm more than happy where we are. Obviously, we'd all like to be in the top half of the table, even higher. But in a very tight league, as it suggests it's going to be, you can move up and down a few places very easily. And I like what Martin Ling did say about the 1.5 points a game is the target, and you've got to sort of stick to that throughout the whole season. If you do lose a few, don't panic, don't get rid of the manager or do anything rash, but if you win a few, don't get too carried away. And at the moment, we are on that figure, he says, and sort of, I think it gives you, say, not 69 points at the end of the season, and history tells you you'd be there or there around the playoffs. So if we can hang in there till March and then put a really good run together, and we can keep ahead of the fixtures, which is going to be important because another one's being rearranged today, the Crawley game, I do believe. So, we're in a good position, and I think any realistic Gorit fan would have took this position at the turn of the year, to be honest, Steve.
I think you're right. Very tight, as you say. We got a good result last night, actually, when Exeter, who are only a point, 2 points below us, they got held at home by Bolton, so they stay below us in 10th. And yes, we've got up to 9th, and Morecambe, who we'll talk about later, only just above us. So what about individuals? Who's impressed you both so far, or maybe not even impressed you too much?
For me, Connor Wilkinson is the... Obviously, Danny Johnson scored the goals. Vigouroux's been outstanding. But for me, Connor Wilkinson's the one who stood out. Maybe not done it over 90 minutes consistently. But when he is, he's absolutely on fire. I mean, he's going past players like they're not even there.
Yeah, for me, I'm a big fan of the keeper. I was at the back end of last season, even though he didn't get a lot of game time. But you could tell when I first see him play, I liked him a lot. And he's proven that. And his kicking's a little bit to be desired at times. He does find touch with quite regularity, but take that away from his shot stopping, and look, I think he's made one or two mistakes this season, so that's excellent. And not everybody will agree with me, but I think Cisse has been a decent presence in the midfield. The only negative I would say about him, he only seems to find the mood one in four games, maybe, when he really looks the player we signed. And it seems to be against the higher-end teams, maybe. But overall, if you took him out of the team, we'd be probably a little bit worse for him, even though I give a special mention to Hector, who feel that he can be called upon any time this season to play in any position, probably in goal if we need him. But as a young starlet coming through, I like Hector. I mean, he's easy on the eye and he's good. But he's made one or two little mistakes as well, which is probably sort of keeping Cisse in the team. But yeah, they're my three for the season so far.
Trev, you were saying about Vigouroux's kicking not being perfect. He must have left them ones out of his Twitter highlights that he released recently.
Yeah, it's funny how they seem to put them out and only the assist they got. But yeah, the one he put out the other day was a blinding kick, wasn't it?
I'm going to stick up for him a little bit on those because I think I might have said before, if you think about what he's got to aim for up front when he's kicking long, he's really only got Connor Wilkinson, who's going to win much in the air unless Angle happens to be playing on the other side. It's no good knocking the ball up Danny Johnson, is it? And Connor tends to stand right on that touchline. So if his kicking is even a little bit askew, it does tend to drift into touch. So I will say that for him. But no, I go along with all those that you've mentioned. Connor Wilkinson, of course, 10 goals already. We had him on the show last week when he did say that he was happy now settling into that wide position, which is good. And also spoke well about how during the summer he deliberately focused on and made a point of focusing on getting more goals. So to be in double figures already as backup for Danny Johnson is great. What about the defence? Lee, you've always liked Dan Happy. I think we can say that he's made one of those positions his own. But what about who plays alongside him?
Yeah, I mean, with Dan Happy, I mean, like you say, I've been a big fan of him since he was young. But I was a bit disappointed with him to start with. I thought he wasn't really like stepping up to the mark, taking responsibility for himself. Like I said, I remember like Darren Purse, how he came into the side years ago as a youngster and just took that position. I thought Dan needed to be a bit more assertive. Since Tunji's come in, it looks like it's given Dan Happy the enthusiasm to sort of like take responsibility. Like he's like the senior defender now. And I thought the last two games he's been outstanding. Tunji looks like he's give him and Ling a lot more confidence.
Yeah, with that, Lee, the other side of it, Dan may be quite happy that the pace of Canola can sort of help him out. Mm. No disrespect to Josh, he has lost that half a yard. And when Dan Happy brings the ball out from defence, and going into the big hole in midfield, he pushes the opponents back, which I like a lot. And he's put some lovely balls, those diagonal balls coming from his left foot across the park have been excellent as well. So, yeah, Anacone has made a massive difference to the side.
Yep, we go along with that. And in the midfield with Cisse or Hector Kyprianou, as you say, Craig Clay for me, good for me when a lot of people seem to think he'd peaked. And Joby alongside him, of course, just keeps going.
Yeah, I mean, like I said before, with Joby, he's phenomenal what he's doing. But at 39 years old, you've got worried that he might pick up an injury and we've got no one to replace him. Let's say Hector's... He looks outstanding, but is he ready for to play consecutive games continuously? I don't know, but that is a worry. Like if Joby was to get injured, I mean, Craig Clay's been immense this season.
We won't go into the Brophy debate as well again. I think we've done that enough times, left back or wide left. But two or three others we ought to mention have been on the fringe a bit because they've all been fighting really for one of those wide positions and only the one on the left really with Connor doing so well. I mean, of course, Lee Angle, JMD, and the one we were so keen to get a new contract for last summer, Rule Sotiriou. None of them really have taken their chance, have they?
No, none of them at all really made that position their own. We all know that Angle likes to go down the middle a bit more and being stuck on the left. But I think in the Salford game, I think he battled quite well out there and he gets a bit of stick, but he done a job for the team. Sotiriou, he's not kicked on as much as most fans were expecting him to from the early days. And JMD, who I'm a big fan of, well... he's just out of favour at the moment. There is little rumours that he may be leaving the club. It's a shame. He's got a lot of talent, but he doesn't do it over 90 minutes, and it's a team game for 90 minutes. He can come on, flashes of brilliance and create goals out of nothing, but it's a 90-minute game, isn't it?
I think with Sotiriou, I think saying he hasn't kicked on is probably a bit harsh because, I mean, I watched him a lot when he was 17, 18-year-old for the youth side. And he was literally playing Danny Johnson's role. He just sort of was up front. Sam Dalby was the one playing behind him, who was doing all the work. Now he's being asked to play in a role that he's never really played. So I'd say he's actually learning. Personally, I'd rather see him, if Johnson's not playing, I'd rather see Sotiriou given a little chance to see what he's like through the middle. But I think he's probably learnt a lot. I mean, he's got a lot to learn, but I'd say he's more of a... like I say, through the middle, you'll see the best of him when he's in the box, not when he's going down the left or dropping into midfield.
No, that's maybe the problem. They all want to be down the middle, and only Connor has settled for being a wide man. Well, you mentioned possible transfers there. Nothing incoming yet, but Miles Judd to Barnet was the first one out. Not unexpected, that one?
No, not at all. He probably has to go out on loan to put himself in the shop window. Yeah, if the rumours or whatever you like to say, alleged activities off the field have hindered him, his on-field progress. So it's a shame because he's a tenacious fullback for me. He's a good defender. And he's never really let the O's down, but he's not going to be in that position of getting down the right and whipping a cross in. He doesn't possess a decent cross. So... it's up to him now to go and seize another opportunity with another football club because, we'd say it a million times, he won't be the first and won't be the last player not to use the talent he's got. But best of luck to him, to be honest, and hopefully he can do well.
Yes, once he's recovered from that, the red card and suspension from, what was it, half an hour into his debut, which was unfortunate to say the least. So that right-back position, has Sam Lynn done enough to make it his own now? Because we haven't seen much of young Jordan Thomas, the other loanee, lately, have we?
I think Jordan Thomas was signed, I think, like when Ross originally set the team up, like we said, it was 4-4-3-3. He see Brophy on one side, and I think he see Jordan Thomas on the other, and they're both attacking. I don't think Jordan Thomas is an out-and-out right-back defender. I think, like I say, he's more of a wing-back. I think that's probably why now we've gone more defensive with the back four. I think that's more why we haven't seen Jordan Thomas. Sam Ling, I'm going to get shot down here, but I like Sam Ling and I think he should get a new contract. But I don't think he should be playing every week. I don't think he's the answer to a right back. But with Sam Ling, for me, he's a good squad player. He's like the Donny Barnard, Daryl McMahon sort of thing, who's always there, good squad player, comes in, does a job. But no, I think we need another right back.
And suffers from his surname, as we well know. So Miles Judd out to Barnet, and the second departure was Josh Wright to Crawley. Was that fairly predictable, both the player and the club, do you think?
Well, it seems that way, doesn't it? Whether he orchestrated a move or not, who knows? But he's probably looking to the future as his football career comes to the end, and he's joining his brother at Crawley. And yeah, he got on the other day, didn't he, for the cup game. But for me, he didn't pull up any trees in either spell he's had at the football club, so who knows? But his best moments were probably Coventry away when he scored a very important goal. Scored the first goal against Cheltenham after losing Justin. And who knows, his career may have been totally different if we hadn't lost Justin, because that's why who signed him. And then he got the late header of Port Vale, but good luck to him. You know, he's got to look to the future, and he was well down the pecking order now. So, yeah, hope he gets a one.
I think with Josh Wright, I think the situation shows that Ross is in charge. Ross is his own man, and he's strong enough to make decisions. I mean, Josh Wright was probably the most experienced midfielder we had, and he did get a lot of game time to start with. But this season, or especially like towards Christmas, he wasn't even on the bench. And I think, like I said, I think that shows a lot about about Ross making the decisions. So, yeah, it's the right move for both parties.
Yeah, well, he will get an early chance, quite possibly, to remind us of what he can do, because, as Trevor said, that Crawley game has literally today been rearranged for a fortnight on Tuesday, February the 2nd. So that's now three successive Tuesday games. We're back to two games every week again, with Carlisle away next Tuesday, then it's Forest Green at home the Tuesday after that, and then Crawley away on February the 2nd. Just one thought on Josh Wright. I wonder about the effect on other Orient squad players. They see a player get a good move like that. He's probably settled up his contract. Suddenly he's on Match of the Day against a Premier League team. I wonder if they're thinking, well, maybe I'd like a bit of that.
Yeah, I'm sure they would be, but like I said, he's been around for quite a while. He's always going to get a move to another league side. Some of our squad players have got a lot of work to do if they leave Orient and they want to go to another league club. They've got a lot of their agents got to do a lot of work. Let's put it that way.
Of course. Just one quick one from me. We've been promised a midfielder and a centre-half. Do we need in midfield what used to be called that ball-playing inside forward? I'm actually thinking probably of a Jimmy Bloomfield-type player, for anyone who remembers him as a player, someone who can put his foot on the ball and play a pass. I just wonder who's the last of that type of player we had. You got any names there?
Well I threw up the only player that we could have like for like, that I enjoyed Steve Dawson's period at the O's. He was a bustling box-to-box player, and he could pick a pass occasionally, and he was never beaten in any time in the game, so he could really liven up the midfield, because he did do some great runs into the box and nicked us a few goals. But like I said to you yesterday on the other recording, it's a conundrum for Martin Ling and Ross to sort out there, and I don't envy him having that job to do, to be honest, Steve.
No. Well, lastly, before we move on, we probably ought to say the elephant in the room by the name of Daniel Johnson. There was a bit of banter on the review of the year between Matt Porter and Kent Teague about selling him. I hope it was banter anyway. But let's be realistic. We're losing £2.5 million this season. We've got a very valuable commodity who in the summer can leave us for nothing at a time when our players' wages overall will go down. So let's say an ambitious League One club whose salary levels are allowed to be a lot higher than ours suddenly put an offer on the table. Is that one we can refuse?
I think it depends how much the offer is. I mean, we've got a few months left on his contract. Are we realistically going to get anything over sort of 50,000, 60,000 offered for him? If that is the case, then no, turn it down and we take a chance and hopefully he sees us through to the playoffs and promotion and then we've got a good reason for him to stay sort of thing. If a club comes in with a ridiculously offer, 150,000 plus, then yeah, cash in, like, you know what I mean? Take the money.
You would take the money?
For 150 grand, like, plus, yeah. But, like I say, I can't see anyone coming in with that offer. So, no, I'd say if it's, like, sort of a silly amount of money, no, I'd keep him here and gamble on the playoffs. And if he goes for nothing, it's a gamble, like, you know, because if we get promoted through his goals, we'll get a lot more than that extra 100,000.
Trevor, would you take the money?
No, no Orient fan would want to see him leave, of course, because he's on course to be like, sort of the leading goal scorer for the O's if he gets 25 goals. I'm with Lee a little bit on £50,000 is a ridiculous amount. If somebody comes in that would have been sort of the type of thing Orient would have done 20 years ago. Hopefully we don't have to do it in sort of the new era with the chairman we got. And what other football club is going to come in with 150,000 in these trying times? Because if we're losing 2.5 million as alleged and we're in a good state, what are other clubs actually losing? Well, okay, maybe a League One club, high end, top eight or that. So the gamble is if he stays and we lose him in the summer for nothing, but his goals could take us to the playoffs, as Lee said, and if we won the playoffs, I know there's no crowds and that to boost our coffers, but there must be prize money. And then next year in the League One, I'm getting carried away there, aren't I? We're in a better place and back to where we were before the disaster happened, should we say. And if we get into that league again, then we're going to be more competitive. And I think, like you rightly said, the money I'm offered to these players then is a lot higher, but it's down to him as well, isn't it? He may have thought, well, I've been here, I've been there, I'm settled here. I don't know if he's a popular amongst the squad or whatever. But if he's happy where he is, and say, for instance, a team in the West Country or Wales come in for him, would he want to move there? Who knows? So hopefully he stays.
There's some good reasons there for yes, for staying. Well, we heard a lot about wages and salary cap in the club's 2020 online review, which was a good listen as ever. Don't overlook how fortunate we are to get that level of communication and transparency from the club. And if you haven't heard it, it's still available on the YouTube channel. And I'd recommend, if you've only got a few minutes, go right to the end and have a listen to Matt Porter's summing up, which I thought was excellent. But I think that review was the first time we'd heard the actual current salary figure for our players being quoted. Martin Ling said 2.3 to 2.4 million a year. We've confirmed that's for players only, not coaches or other staff. So very roughly, that's about £2,000 a week, which is not enormous Premier League money, but it's good money, of course. However, if we don't get promotion, if we stay in League Two, that overall figure would have to be reduced by about 600,000. It won't go down to 1.5 straight away, but it goes down to about 1.7 the first year. Under 21 players don't count, but you're still talking about an average Orient player. That's maybe a wage cut of between 25 to 30%. I mean, is that a problem for people coming in and trying to renegotiate their contract?
Well, if they want to play football and that's the deal on the table, then they probably have to take it. Like everybody is having to reassess their budgets just because of this current COVID crisis. I mean, football has been in need of an overhaul for many, many years. And it should also be that the players will then strive to give everything to get into the higher leagues to get the higher money. So you may lose a few passengers who are happy to sit on the bench for their money. But I think we all have to be realistic. And our chairman's been heavily involved with the EFL on this, and they're very passionate and feel strongly about it. And I guess we're going to have to set by example, to be honest.
Yeah, and the positive slant on it, I suppose, probably say to the players at the moment, well, the best thing you can do is get us promoted, because the cap in League One is not 1.5 million, it's 2.5 million, which gives the club a lot more to play with if they can find the money. So that push towards promotion continues on Saturday at home to Morecambe, and then, as we said, next Tuesday at Carlisle. Any thoughts about Morecambe, Trevor?
I've not really thought that far ahead, to be honest, this week, Steve. But one
ahead of us in the table.
We had a great first half up there by all accounts, and then we sort of switched off a little bit and they reorganised and come out in the second half quite strong. I mean, he's got them playing quite well. I mean, I don't think I would have put them in the top half of the table if you give me the chance at the start of the season to do a fantasy league who's going to finish where. So it'd be a difficult proposition for us as he sets them up pretty well. So, well, the home form's good. I mean, we've got more problems with the away form at the moment, and then going to a quick turnaround to Carlisle on a Tuesday is, I think that's where the problem lies.
Yes. Lee, ever been up to Carlisle? We've had some funny old games up there. We remember 5-0 down at half-time 1 year?
Yeah, I mean, I've been up there a few times. I don't think I've ever seen us win up there, though. That's the worst thing. Yeah, I mean, Carlisle's one of those trips that you just never know what you're going to get out of it, do you? Like, you know, we either get smashed or we nick a win. I think I was looking at the next three games, and I think they're all very tough games as it stands at the moment. So I think if we took 6 points out of the next three games, I'd be more than happy with that. Where they'll come, what two out of three games will come from, don't know. It's very tough games.
Sorry, Steve. What I would say though is when they on that review, what they explain, what the players do go for the away games, it does go to show that. I don't know what the overall average is in the league of home wins versus away wins, but generally the O's have been very good away from home in recent years, and this must be so disruptive for the team at the different kickoff times, which I passionately hate 1 p.m. kickoffs. But I understand why they do it, because Martin did explain to us. But it must really affect them, and the turnaround for that game is really, really quick. And like I say, I'd have loved to have been going there on a Tuesday night.
Yes, one good win you might remember. Remember that first game of the season, 5-1? I think that was our playoff season, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think we were four up at the time. So
not a complete bogey. Right, well, we're almost at half-time, and we're going to make a substitution here for the second half. Would you please show your appreciation for the man coming off, Mr. Lee Boyce? Thank you, Lee. Great to have you back. We'll hear from you soon again. But now it's high time that, as advertised, we got to our interview with David Bloomfield. Let me apologise in advance if some of the audio quality on the questions isn't perfect. Difficult conditions we're working under, as you know, but the answers are the important bit. Jimmy Bloomfield, of course, player manager and then manager from 68 to 71, manager again from 77 to 81. He was a very distinguished player. He was a Londoner, played for a couple of leading London amateur clubs, and then Brentford and Arsenal. And David, his son, was born during the Arsenal period, but a bit young to be going to Highbury. So I wondered, was his first experience watching his dad probably at Birmingham City, where he played 1960 to 64?
Yeah, I remember this would be the early 60s, and I'd be 4 or 5 years of age, and used to be taken to the games by my mum. But I'd be more interested in the steam train that used to go behind one of the goals at Birmingham, the way the train and the steam used to fascinate me more than what was going on the pitch. How I regret that now.
I think we saw him actually at Brisbane Road that year, because 62-63, our one first division year, he not only played for Birmingham in the 2-2 draw just before Christmas, but he actually scored both goals. But he wasn't just a creative inside forward as I described, was he? But he could find the net as well.
Yeah, I think he was the kind of player that you want to be looking for, a midfielder that gets 10 goals plus a season, and as well as creating a few.
Yeah, and it ended up really with over 100 in total in all his career, in perhaps 500 or so games.
Yeah, his career really would be around about 500 first-team matches, scoring about 100 goals.
And after that, it was back to London, Brentford, West Ham, then down to Plymouth briefly, and then, early 1968, February, March, you're about 11 years old, Dick Graham resigns at Orient. I think he was one of many Orient managers who'd got fed up with not quite having enough much money to spend. We were struggling right down at the bottom of the third division. You tell us what happens next.
Well, my dad had actually applied for the manager's job at Plymouth, but didn't get that.
And I think in those days, perhaps it's still the case now, that if you are looking for a manager's job, your first manager's job, if you can actually still play, I think the board thought, well, okay, well, at least we're going to get a player out of this, however it turns out. So my dad played for a season, I think, something like that, for the Orient before becoming solely the manager.
Yes, that's absolutely right. In fact, I managed to dig out the first programme after he signed, and Arthur Page, the chairman, as well as being very complimentary about him and how impressed they were with him, said that the board had been very keen to secure a player manager, I think was the phrase, which you could just understand with Orient. Immediately started with a first away win of the season, actually, at Gillingham, and we avoided relegation. And then the next season, he played about 30-odd games, still another relegation struggle, which we came to on the last day, epic game at home to Shrewsbury, which we had to win, and won 4-0. Were you going to games by then?
I was a regular avid supporter by this stage. I'm watching very closely what's going on. In fact, that night that you refer to, I remember there were people dancing Cossack style on the pitch, celebrating the fact that we had avoided the drop. And that season, I think Northampton had already been relegated due to financial irregularities. So I remember my dad's particularly keen to say that we were not going to go down, and we were not going to use that as an escape clause. We were going to be above those bottom four teams.
I was probably one of those on the pitch, in fact, that Shrewsbury win. But player-manager, especially at that level, is a tough old job, isn't it?
Yes, but, you know, my dad loved playing. I mean, even till into his 40s, he would take part in the training. I've seen him play in the gym at Leicester and at Orient. You know, he would like to take part, and he would do demos. You know, if he wanted a free kick taken in a particular way, he'd knock it in there first. So, you know, if you love it, I think it's certainly pressurised, but it's pressure that you enjoy, really, I think, ultimately.
Of course. And then the famous 1969-70 season, when he decided to stand down as a player, which was probably sensible, was able to lead a very exciting season that ended up going from 2 points from relegation the previous season to being champions. I'm sure we were written off before the season as relegation fodder, as was normal in those days. The average attendance, I think, doubled to over 11,000. I don't know if you remember the Boxing Day game against Luton, who were our biggest rivals. Over 17,500 there, with Malcolm McDonald and the rest getting beaten.
Yeah, I remember that one. The other game I particularly remember of that season is beating Plymouth Argyle, previously mentioned, on around the Easter.
That was
18,000 at that game, and I have to say, I was so happy. I was actually crying at the end of that game. I'd be about 12, I guess, and I was actually exhilarated by what I had seen. It was just fantastic.
Trevor, we look back at days of 17,000 and 18,000, a little bit before your time then, but even that makes you feel quite nostalgic, but I suppose also makes you feel just, you know, the potential that the club had at one stage.
Yeah, I mean, later on in the 70s, we went very close, didn't we? But that season, I mean, I noted down that we only used 16 players, and out of that, Mick Jones, Tommy Taylor, Peter Allen and Barry Dyson were all ever present. Goddard, Rolfe and Bullock only missed seven games between them. So having a squad 17, 18 players work then, well, does it work now? But yeah, I can imagine what the ground was like, and just picturing the West Side all standing and running onto the pitch. And like I mentioned to you earlier, that we played our last four games on a Wednesday, a Monday, and a Saturday, and a Monday. Do you remember the end of the season, David, for that?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember one game in particular. I think Orient played at 5:30 on Saturday evening to capitalise on any football supporters who had been to the cup final earlier that day. I was certainly amongst them. I can remember running from Wembley to get on the train to get to the Orient for that evening game. I can remember thinking, golly, Wembley Stadium's a bit bigger than Brisbane Road, isn't it? Because I'd seen one and then I'd seen the other within about an hour of each other. But no, great atmosphere down there at Brisbane Road, and a great confidence I think we had home and away that, you know, we were going to do something.
Yes, great, great days. And then by the end of the next season, back in the second division, comfortable again from relegation, though very few goals scored in that season. And Leicester City, who you mentioned earlier, come calling. They just won the second division championship, but they lost their manager, Frank O'Farrell, to Manchester United. How did the move come about, and was there much family discussion about moving to Leicester?
Well, we always tended to have a family discussion if there were things of you know, that scale. And I can remember, you know, a discussion around the kitchen table about it. And I was thinking, I think I'll be able to get some really interesting players in my autograph book. I've got all the guys in the second division. So I was certainly voting for it on the basis of my autograph book. But initially, Leicester came forward and my dad turned them down. And then they came back and... Mr. Zussman said to my dad, look, Jim, they're offering you double your money. You really have to go. So, I mean, we wanted to go in the sense that it was a step up to the first division, but we absolutely loved being at the Orient.
Right. So
I think in actual fact, Orient got a compensation fee of about £10,000.
I did read that, and I'm sure, yes, that would have appealed to them, certainly. So the O's then appointed George Petchy, who had been a highly regarded coach at Crystal Palace, of course, brought a lot of their players with him eventually. And lo and behold, in the first season of both managers at their new clubs, the FA Cup fourth round draw, Leicester City will play Orient. How did you feel about that one?
Well, I thought by the end of the game, it was an absolute nightmare because, you know, losing 2-0, I can remember Dad the day or so before said to me, what's the worst thing that could have happened? And I was struggling to find out. He goes, yeah, that's right. Peter Shilton is injured and we've got this relative novice coming in. And then Ian Boyer, my dad's last signing for the club, comes and scores a goal. So everything conspired on that occasion against our family. Great occasion for the O's, no doubt about that. But I did have to face the wrath of my peers at school the following on the Monday, having been knocked out by a club from a lower division.
It was a great giant killing, that one. Yes, as you say, Peter Shilton got injured. Carl Jays, I think it was, who... They took over in goal and almost threw one in for us in a memorable 2-0 win, which of course got us the famous home tie with Chelsea as well. And Jim, yeah,
I have to say, in those times, I mean, I'm not following Orient as avidly as I did, obviously. But you know, you still want the Orient to do well. That was never extinguished, although. You know, it's an odd thing when it's your dad managing a club. You're so passionate about it at the time. But that loyalty that you have to that club can change, you know, in an afternoon. If my dad suddenly managed another club, then I'm following them. But then when you get a bit older, you sort of look back and you really have got such great fond memories of the Orient in both those spells. But also, you know, when George Petch is there, we think we always used to say that keeping Orient in the second tier is a phenomenal achievement, and George Petch did that and nearly got them up into the first division, clearly.
Yes, I think that's fair, and what has happened since I think probably illustrates to younger fans what an achievement it was to keep them as a second division club for a long time overall, as you say. So Jim had 7 years altogether at Leicester until the end of 76-77. Pretty successful. I mean, never in any great danger of relegation, and they got an FA Cup semi-final, didn't they? But what happened round about the end of 76-77?
Well, I think after a while, when you've been to a club, unless you get backing by the board and you're able to change a significant number of the players... The players have heard a lot of the tactics, and it can become a little bit stale. I mean, I think perhaps my dad should have taken the Everton job when he was offered that, when Billy Bingham got the sack. And I think perhaps there's a natural lifespan to a football manager, however good you are, unless you're getting that success, as Ferguson illustrated, Manchester United, or you've got a board that will back you, and you can freshen it up, really, by bringing in some new players. You have to have that turnover, I think.
Yeah. And George Pesci was sacked then at Orient after just a couple of defeats right at the start of the season. I think he was probably suffering from the same sort of thing you were talking about. Chairman Brian Winston was growing tired of the same old thing and struggling a lot of the time. What he'd done, of course, just before that was bring in a striker called Peter Kitchen, and your dad certainly got the benefit of that.
Yes, I mean, that was a great signing by George Pesci, and Peter Kitchen was his goal was obviously instrumental in the cup run. The side was set up with wingers and a big centre forward in Joe Mayo for Peter to be on the end of things. So it was set up for him to be the focal point, but you've got to be good enough to take the chances, and Peter clearly was.
Yeah, Trevor, you hadn't quite got in time for that the great cup run, but you'll remember the Kitchen-Mayo partnership, which I suppose was a classic big man, smaller man goal-scoring partnership, wasn't it?
Yeah, I started going to the O's about 6 months after that, so missed out on that, but I relived it all again this morning. What you lucky fellas got to see, and... Yeah, they big man, little man always works, but they complemented each other. And I think they actually liked each other off the pitch, which I think is also very good for strikers. You know, when I've met them both at various Orient dues, they're both affable chaps, and you can see why that partnership worked.
Yeah, it started, of course, the cup run with Norwich and a replay. There's a lot of replays along the way. Norwich and then Blackburn and then Chelsea, who held us at Brisbane Road, and then that was one of the great nights, David, the replay at Stamford Bridge, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if I could just go back to the Blackburn Rovers game, I can remember that quite clearly. We're losing 1-0 in the second half, and with just one sub, you're rather limited as to, you know, what you can do about it. So my dad put Nigel Gray up as centre-forward, which really turned the game round, and I can remember what... We equalised pretty soon after Nigel had gone up front, and Nigel looked over to the bench to see if he could sort of go back, revert back to his centre-half position. But he was given the instruction, no, stay up there, see what you can do. And we ran out 3-1.
Yeah, and then Chelsea and Peter Kitchen again.
Yeah, I saw that goal, the one, the Maisie dribble. I saw it on... YouTube the other day, and I'd say, yeah, that really is a fantastic goal, and you're shouting at him, shoot, and he does eventually, despite lots of efforts by Chelsea defenders, but fantastic goal.
David, do you know that I did speak to Peter Kitchen, and everybody talked to him about that Chelsea goal, but do you know his favourite goal is in the sixth round against Middlesbrough?
And, yeah, it's a slight looping one, isn't it? There's a fair few tasty ones. I quite like the, I don't know if it's on film, perhaps it is somewhere, the goal at Norwich in the replay. Absolutely white-hot atmosphere there, the FA Cup replays in those days used to get, because they were played a day or so after the original tie. So the momentum going into those replays used to be fantastic, and played really well at Norwich, and it was Kitchen who got the winner there.
Yeah, 20,000 there that day for that one, so you're absolutely right. There would be people queuing up on a Sunday morning to pick your tickets up, wouldn't it? So,
yeah, and it had been called off a couple of days earlier. We'd got all the way to Norwich, but as we were driving on the road, my mum and I, you know, we could sense that this game wasn't going to be off, because it was just hammering down. Then it was played again a day or two later.
And Middlesbrough away in the quarter-final, which of course was as far as we'd ever got in the Cup before, was hardly the most attractive or the draw you really wanted at that stage, was it?
No, but you know, you get what you're given. The top flight team. They obviously fancy their chances. It's when you get a draw there, you think, yeah, well, that was a really sound defensive performance. But I think there was a slight element of luck that Middlesbrough really had loads of chances on that day, but they were kept up by Stonewall Jackson and a five-man sweeper-led defence that Orient had at the time.
Yes, the great John Jackson in goal, who would certainly win many votes as our most popular goalkeeper ever. So that famous replay win, the Kitchen and Mayo win against Middlesbrough, and the semi-final is Orient, Arsenal, Ipswich, West Bromwich Albion. We come out against Arsenal. The other thing we should mention, of course, a very key moment was that I think after some stage after the third round, John Chidozie, who was very much the star winger, the little right winger, had broken his leg, hadn't he? I think in a youth team game, and we knew was going to be out for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I think he was playing in an FA Youth Cup, which really was a competition that clubs judge their youth players by. And you can get a lot of status attached to that competition. And John suffered a broken leg. I mean, fortunate enough that in the wings, literally, was another winger in Kevin Godfrey. But, you know, you do wonder sometimes, had John been able to play against Arsenal, would he have done anything against them? But luck was against us in that tie, even before it was played, wasn't it, with John's injury and then McDonald's corner-bound efforts ending up in the back of our net.
Yeah, and Kevin Godfrey actually didn't get the vote. We were reminded by Dennis on Facebook. Dennis, a real outstanding old Orient supporter, says Derek Clark was actually, if you remember.
Yeah, I think Kevin was the sub, wasn't he?
Yeah, and Derek Clark, who wasn't really a winger. But to be honest, against that Arsenal team, who I think, what, three successive finals they got to around that time, didn't they? That was a pretty big ask.
Yeah, but I have to say, going into it at home, you know, we thought, why not? You know, no reason. Okay, we're Orient and they're Arsenal, but so what, really? I think perhaps that might have been the element of naivety in retrospect, but at the time, at home, we thought, yeah, okay, take them on.
David, what was the press coverage like? Did they come to your home or was your dad in big demand leading up to that semi-final?
Yeah, I mean, also my dad around that time, and he was in hospital quite a bit, and his trusted and very able assistant, Peter Angel, would be taking a lot of the training. I mean, my dad wasn't actually at the Chelsea replay or the Middlesbrough away game. So he was sort of following it on the phone and liaising with Peter. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of media coverage if a team reaches the semi-final. I think it's a slightly different level now. There are so many more arms of the media for you to get attention. But, you know, Orient getting to the semi-final any year is going to attract the media.
There were a good few cuttings for the newspaper scrapbooks, I think, after that. The other thing about that season, briefly, people look at the league table and see we finished 14th, which was a fairly normal sort of position, but it was actually so ridiculously close at the bottom that we had to win the final league game at Cardiff. And if you look at that table, seven teams all finished on the same number of points, 38 points, and Blackpool got 37 and were relegated. So I'm sure you remember the last game of the season, which in many ways was the most important of the whole lot, wasn't it, at Cardiff?
Yeah, I mean, looking back, Orient were on a bit of a tightrope going into that match. But again, I have to say, at home, we had no doubt that the job that had to be accomplished, a win at Ninian Park, was something that could be pulled off. There was absolutely no doubt about it in our minds. And I think sometimes when you have to win rather than sneak a draw, I think it sort of clarifies the mind somewhat, and you knew you had to win and the task is as simple and as basic and as you just have to do it.
And we did, which was the main thing. But as you say, your dad had been in and out of hospital, which must have been a cause for concern. And the following year, 1979, there was a real tragedy when Peter Angel, who'd been his coach, of course, his first team coach, died in very similar circumstances to Justin Edinburgh, I think. You must have known Peter very well at that stage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd known Peter since I'd been about 10 or 11. Very dapper, well-dressed man was Peter. We often had scampi and chips in the Orient fish bar after training, because I'd always be down there during school summer holidays, climbing up the pylons or watching the training. So Peter sadly died in Epping Forest out on a pre-season run. 49 as well.
Yes, terrible. Terrible, but Jim carried on, and Trevor, as we say, you were on board by then, and memories of what must have been early days for you. A key period, I always felt, was about 1980. We've got players like Ralph Coates from Spurs, and then Stan Bowles and Peter Taylor, all former England internationals, exciting attacking players. I mean, the board then seemed to be showing some real ambition, but then it seemed to me it was almost as if they gave up a bit.
Yeah, when I come, first thing I see, the debut was at the Valley, and Ian Moore's got a brace, and it was great. First time in a football ground, that was it. You're hooked for life, and they didn't get hooked for life in Orient. But with Bowles, Taylor, Moore's, Roffey, all that, we were in good company. I mean, we were playing Chelsea, Sunderland, West Ham, Newcastle. Now,
and winning at Upton Park.
Yeah, the glorious one on Boxing Day, yeah. But we were in good company. So, you know, I think our highest position we got, I see them, was about seventh in that thing. You think, oh, can we? But though we were up some powerhouses. When you got to, like, St James's Park, 35,000, Upton Park, I mean, it's a privilege to actually watch football at these football grounds, isn't it, when they were packed and things like that. But we just didn't have the money. And that's been the history from Dot with the Orient, I'm afraid. But, yeah, they're great times, and I'm glad I was witness to this.
I mean, my dad's ambition was, without a shadow of a doubt, to get Orient back into the top flight. And those sort of players that you mentioned, I mean, Stan Bowles, he was playing for Notts Forest in the European Cup 1 week, and next week he's at Brisbane Road. So that's the sort of level, you know, you're trying to bring into the club to take it on stage further. And, you know, I think if my dad had been well and you hadn't had the board interfering over much, I would suggest, that club and the side and the squad that was being put together, there was a clear ambition and I think steady progress, as I mentioned earlier, to getting the club back into the first division.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, sorry, Steve. Yeah, definitely. You got a valid point there. And it's such a shame that we find out that his illness and things like that has hampered the O's and the ball, because isn't that a contentious moment when they sold Chidozie, I suppose?
Well, Chidozie is a key element, really, in my dad leaving. First of all, he thought the transfer fee at the time, $350,000, wasn't really what John was worth. And was it a great move for John Orient to Notts County? Well, he's not going too far up the pyramid, isn't he? So my dad's notion was, okay, at some stage, John might well be sold, but let him go to a big club like Spurs, as he did eventually end up, because that would be a great selling point, in a way, for young players to come to the Orient, to see that there is a clear route to the top by putting on a red shirt and playing for Orient at Brisbane Road. And also, you'd get sizeable money there. You could actually do something and improve the team. I mean, you go back to my dad's very early spell at the club. There was a striker called Vic Hallam who moved 4,000 or so. And that the money that that brought in enabled, you know, the likes of Mark Lazarus, Mickey Bullock, Barry Dyson to come in the club. So if you sell a player, it's what you do with the money that comes in. And a big transfer fee from John could have been
that have been spent wisely. Again, overall, the objective is to increase the quality of the playing squad.
David, we're out of time. Been great hearing from you, and we as supporters will certainly all remember Jimmy Bloomfield with great affection and gratitude. And as I say, when the Football League did a poll a few years back to mark the 125th anniversary, supporters did vote him our best ever manager. Well, that's really it. Big thanks to...
Sorry about that. We seem to have lost our connection there. So we're coming towards the end of the programme of this mix and match evening, because yesterday afternoon we had a Zoom call and we had some technical problems with Steve's end, and that he sounded a bit like a Dalek. But overall, while listening to that, I think it was quite audible. So I don't know if Steve's still with us or not. But
hello, Trev. I'm still here.
Hello, mate. It's all right. We got caught napping there. Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed listening back to the interview, and it wasn't as bad as what we thought, was it?
Good.
Really?
No. Great thanks to David Bloomfield for reliving those Jimmy Bloomfield years for us. The man who, in a Football League survey, 7 years ago, was named as our most popular manager ever. Was great hearing from him. So we're out of time, really. That's it. A big thanks, Trevor. Thanks to Lee Boyce and to David Bloomfield for all that. To Andy and Billy for the editing, and Karen for getting the podcast out. The Orient Hour on Phoenix 98 FM, 7 p.m. every Wednesday, and available as a podcast soon. So until the next time, stay safe, keep those Orient masks on, stay positive, and up the O's.
Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM News.